You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's November 9th, 2025. You know, life can be difficult for us. We have to feed Marcel by hand now. You know, Marcel has cancer. My beautiful black, little black panther. And his appointment is on Saturday. We're going to see exactly what they can do and what they can't do. It's like losing, you know, a family member, you know. And as I feed him, my wife said the same thing. He has these bright green eyes. His face isn't expressive, but his eyes are, and he has the most... He has the most thankful, you know, just the most thankful look on his eyes. Thank you for taking care of me. It's just very, it's very strong with him. I found him as a kitten, a little kitten. Someone called me from Shippensburg, of all places, saying that there was a cat found, a little tiny, tiny thing. And they thought, well, call Matt. He'll take anyone. I said, okay. So I did. And that was over 10 years ago. So, not to mention, I'm not feeling the best either for some reason. My wife, of course, is in constant pain because of her psoriatic arthritis, but I have a job to do. I have a job to do, a job that I've known, I've had to do since I was 18 years old. And that is to mock and debunk the pretensions of the current oligarchy, of liberalism, of leftism, of globalism, whatever you want to call it. To continue to press on the fact that everything, that the average educated American, that is, the average normie American, with a college education, believes is incorrect. This year, 2025, there are no statesmen in the Western world. Maybe the last one in the U.S. was Richard Nixon, possibly. The statesman is inherently conservative, inherently cautious, is experienced. They understand constitutional principles, whatever country they're in, and they represent those relative to, of course, divine law, the will of the people, and the common good of the nation over time. They have the fortitude and integrity to take the high road, stand firm, and present unpopular truth, but truth, not unpopular truth in general, but from their own experience. G.K. Chesterton once said, "The men whom the people ought to choose to represent them are too busy to take those jobs, but the politician is waiting for it. He is the pestilence of modern times. What we should try to do is make politics as local as possible, keep the politicians near enough to kick them." I can't help but think of Bashar al-Assad, who was never a politician, never wanted to be, had a thriving, he was an eye doctor in Britain with a thriving practice. Can you imagine being thrown into that? Nicholas II, though, you know, was something similar. He was put in a position of power at an extremely difficult time. But deliberate decision making is a hallmark of a statesman. He understands how processes work. You don't promise things to people. A circumstance, analysis, consideration. Sometimes there's nothing you can do. The statesman is knowledgeable in basic political theory, while also being experienced in statecraft itself. Statesman doesn't exist to impress anybody. They're accountable to God and the nation. They're not concerned with the next election, but with the next generation. Statesman tells the truth even when their position is unpopular. And Edmund Burke was well aware of this. When he was in Parliament as an Irish Protestant, he struggled. He said, your representative owes you, not his industry only, but his judgment. And he betrays instead of serving you if he sacrifices it for your opinion. The politician is a used car salesman. There's a solution to a problem. Every issue becomes some kind of transaction. But the statesman always understands that compromise or efficiency or speed, this isn't the purpose of governing. He laughs at people who complain about gridlock. Gridlock was built in to the U.S. Constitution, these ignoramuses. It was designed to make laws difficult to pass. It forces a deliberative process, so that a crisis at any given moment won't be able to change laws because of the emotions of the media at the time. Statesmen are very loath to change laws. Thomas Sowell said that no one will really understand politics until they understand that politicians are not trying to solve your problems. They are trying to solve their own problems, of which getting elected and reelected are number one and number two. Whatever is number three is far behind. In other words, politicians seek their own self-interest. They are the very opposite of statesmanship. They are grotesque. So again, we're going to talk about Tsar Nicholas II. He was a statesman, which is why so many misunderstand him. He spoke all European languages. He had a military education. He was taught basic political theory, history, legal thought. But most of all, he was taught that his job was not to please anyone in particular, but to do what was best for Russia. See, when those who have never seen a statesman are confronted with an actual a true leader, a real statesman, they don't know what to do. The lack of understanding breeds contempt. But it's very difficult to imagine any statesman ever rising again in the West. Although I will say that the Tsar of Russia, many of them, can be used as a template. So now, we're in August 1915, beginning of the second year of World War I. Russia's military situation is not great. The Russian army was suffering staggering losses. But those losses didn't come from nothing. They were caused from premature attacks on East Prussia. Why premature? Because the French demanded it to relieve pressure on the Western Front. 1915 is the point where the British began to run out of shells. The Germans, rather than consent to trench warfare, used poison gas for the first time that year. So they went to Russia as the only solution to their problems. Russia, too, suffered from a shortage of shells and other combat equipment. There were many errors by the Supreme Command. But shortages and struggle. No one knew this war was going to be like this. No one knew it was going to slaughter so many people. This was something unprecedented. Now, there were many victories early on, especially against Austria-Hungary. Afterwards, though, there was a general retreat. The Galician Front, May 21st, the Austrian fortress of Przemysl was abandoned. On June 9th, Austro-Hungarian troops occupied Lvov, the capital of Galicia in western Ukraine, where just 2 months before, the Tsar had visited and had been celebrated. The military events of a single month destroy the fruit of a struggle lasting almost a year, of bitter fighting. News from the front, one story more tragic than the next, spread through Europe, Europe's capital. On the northern front, Warsaw was abandoned in July, and then a hasty evacuation of Riga was announced. It was a disaster. At the same time, the situation domestically became very intense. From the very beginning of the war, the headquarters of the Supreme Commander-in-Chief, who at that time was Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, constantly interfered in the affairs of the civilian side of things, causing all kinds of misunderstanding in the Council of Ministers, creating chaos. As the theater of military operations expanded throughout Western Russia, the dual power between headquarters and the Council of Ministers became completely unbearable. People were even talking about him becoming a Napoleon Bonaparte, because he began addressing people as if he were a monarch. These were the circumstances that forced Tsar Nicholas to assume supreme command of the military. This was a very important decision. This is a decision on which the fate of Russia depended. It was made independently. He had no pressure from anybody. However, the negative people trying to talk him out of it were many. Among the government ministers, the so-called people's representatives of the Duma, they had this, what they call the panicky indignation, arose over the Tsar's decision. Ministers like Sazonov, Revolshin, Karinto, Shabatov, Samarin, even the Minister of War, General Polivanov, they launched a storm of protests, condemning the Tsar's decision to take command. The later meetings of the Council of Ministers, a panicky confusion reigned with predictions of catastrophe for Russia, the explosion of a powder keg, the revolution, even the death of the monarchy. General Polivanov went so far as to openly express his opinion of the Tsar's incompetence in the military arena. Foreign Minister Sazonov called the Tsar's decision horrible, dangerous, and disastrous. What an abyss Russia is thrusting itself into. Minister of Internal Affairs, Prince Shcherbatov, foresaw a rebellion at the front. He renounced responsibility for the safety of the Tsar and his family in Tsarskoe Selo. Minister Karitonov doubted that Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich would willingly yield his position to the Tsar. In other words, he considered a mutiny of His Highness and the army against the Tsar a possibility. Minister of Agriculture, Silverstein, who actually served as head of government in Crimea under General Denikin, very much underestimated him. And he said, the fate of Russia, the entire world is at stake. We must protest, beg, plead, insist to prevent His Majesty from taking this irreversible step. The fate of the dynasty, the throne, is at stake. The monarchical idea is being dealt a blow. Yeah, it was hysteria. Now, I just don't know if it was because it would succeed or it would fail. Oh, there's more. The procurator of the Holy Synod, Alexander Samarin, expected dire consequences from the change of supreme command. One spark is enough to ignite a fire. The Tsar's assumption of command of the army will no longer be a spark, but a whole candle thrown into a powder keg. The State Duma chairman, Rodzianko, he ended up being one of the leaders of the February Revolution. Upon learning of the Tsar's decision, immediately went to Tsarskoe Selo, requested an urgent audience, during which he persistently tried to persuade the Tsar to abandon his intention to lead the army. Nicholas said clearly, "My decision is irrevocable." He was surrounded with men who didn't understand him. He had a pitiful government, apparently unaware of the disaster of the Eastern Front. They even wrote him a collective letter. And here's how it ended. "Seeing such conditions, we are losing faith in you and our ability to serve you in the motherland with any sense of benefit." That's an ultimatum. It was signed by a bunch of people. The Prime Minister, Ivan Gromykin, Minister of Justice, Alexander Gvozdov. Now, Gromykin said in his statement, "I'm a man of the old school. For me, the imperial command is law. When disaster strikes at the front, His Majesty considers it the sacred duty of the Russian Tsar to be among the troops and either win or perish with them. No arguments will persuade him to abandon his intended step. Neither intrigue nor anyone's influence plays any role in his decision. All that remains is to bow to the will of our Tsar and assist him. In my conscience, the sovereign emperor is God's anointed, the bearer of the supreme authority. He personifies Russia. He's 47 years old. He has reigned and directed the destiny of the Russian people for a long time. And the will of such a man is determined, and the course of action is chosen. Loyal subjects should submit, whatever the consequences. And then comes God's will. So I think, my consciousness, I will die." Gromykin was probably the only guy who ultimately stayed with him throughout all of this. And the theme of these years in the Tsar's life is that he was very much alone. The press went wild. And it didn't come just from the left. It came from the right as well. Emperor Nicholas was to possess great willpower, remarkable strength of character, and very broad outlook of the leader in order to remain unshakable in this fateful decision to boldly accept the challenge of both external and internal enemies, including the weak people in his entourage. Well, contrary to all predictions, fears, intimidation, the Tsar's decisions was absolutely correct, and it led to excellent results. It revealed not just the Tsar's firmness of character, but his profound military insight. The Tsar's assumption of supreme command was greeted with enthusiasm by the rank and file in the army. He arrived at headquarters on August 23rd of that year, and his order read, "On this day, I have assumed command of all land and naval forces present in the theater of military operations with firm faith in God's help, unshakable confidence in ultimate victory. We will fulfill our sacred duty to defend the motherland to the end and will not disgrace the Russian land." Well, Lazar chose two people as his inner circle. General Mikhail Alexeyev, that became the chief of staff, and General Alexander Lukomsky. He was a quartermaster general. Grand Duke Nicholas Nikolaevich and his staff, they were transferred to the Caucasian front. And he got rid of a bunch of ministers for their contempt of the Tsar's decision. Remember, Russian Tsars were military men. They had military training. They loved the army. They took all their needs to heart, especially in the 19th century. Nicholas received an excellent military education from childhood. And like most monarchs, he served in all branches of the armed forces, then received an extensive secondary military education. He participated in military maneuvers annually. He always furthered his knowledge in military theory and strategy. He knew many of the army's personnel very well. Yeah, he had no combat experience, that's obviously true. And he never commanded large military units, but that gap was filled by General Alexeyev. The Tsar possessed two qualities that his assistant lacked. He possessed extraordinary self-control and an enormous ability to quickly and soberly assess the situation under any circumstances, no matter how dire. The women in the Tsar's family also took a crash course in nursing and rushed to the front. They put themselves into the line of fire as combat medics. There was one official at headquarters. They testified in their memoirs that they saw General Alexeyev many times in the operations room, extremely confused and panicked under the influence of alarming news. But after reporting to the Tsar and discussing options, he was completely transformed and quickly took the necessary measures. So they seemed to complement each other very well. And many, many beneficial results came from it. Within 3 weeks, the situation had changed radically at the front. The German offensive was stopped. And a short time later, Russian troops, with short strikes in individual sections, especially against Austria, they went on the offensive. It was an enormous boost of morale. He fought alongside the lowest Russian private, even ate with them. Now, don't take my word for it, though. Take someone who hated Russia. Take their word for it. Winston Churchill, who at the time was British Secretary of War, here's what he said. There are few episodes in the Great War more striking than the resurrection, rearmament, and renewed gigantic effort of Russia in 1916. By the summer of 1916, Russia, which 18 months before had been almost unarmed. That's an exaggeration, by the way. Which during 1915 had suffered an uninterrupted series of terrible defeats, had actually managed by her own efforts and using the resources of the Allies to put into the field to organize, arm, supply 60 Army Corps, which would amount to 240 divisions, instead of the 35 with which she began the war. In other words, Russian infantry went into action prematurely because the French needed to be relieved at the front. They would never have done it otherwise. But that success, we're going to quote from him a little bit more because he just goes on and on about the success of Tsar Nicholas at the front. It belongs to him. It belongs to Nicholas II. Oldenburg, who was a first-rate historian of the era, he says, the most forgotten and difficult feat of Emperor Nicholas was that under incredibly difficult conditions, he brought Russia to the threshold of victory. His opponents did not allow her to cross the threshold. The struggle of that emperor had to endure during the very last months of his reign, and even greater extent, these events at the end of the Japanese War, recalls Posokov, words about his sovereign predecessor. does not have many accomplices at his request, even if he himself can pull 10 men up the mountain, millions are pulled down the mountain, whatever that means. Politically speaking, when a monarch wins a war of global importance like this, it solidifies his reign and his hold on power. He becomes unassailable. This is why I say I think the oligarchy, which includes many military generals, didn't like him taking over, because really anything was better than what it was in 1915. Failure would have been one thing. He could have been easily overthrown then, maybe. But if he succeeded, it's a problem for the growing conspiracy around him that would soon pretend he abdicated. He's never abdicated, never once. In reality, he was pushed out of power, arrested, and of course, brutally murdered. So by 1917, the Russian army numbered around 8 million men. Depots, both near the front and anywhere, were overflowing with shells, machine guns, rifles, ammunition, anything needed for combat. The army's artillery was fully equipped. Artillery divisions had vast reserves of guns of every type, including very heavy ones. During the winter lull, troops at the front rested and underwent additional training. Morale was extremely high at this point. Everyone understood that they recognized Russia as a great power, just beginning to show itself. Everyone understood that the decisive moment was approaching and victory was in sight. The April offensive was bound to crush the enemy. Russia stood on the threshold of victory. General Lakovitsky writes, "It took Peter the Great 9 years to turn the defeated forces at Narva into the victors at Poltava. The last Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial Army, Nicholas II, accomplished the same great task in 1.5 years. But his work was also appreciated by his enemies. And between the Tsar, the army, and victory, revolution stood." Let me quote Winston Churchill again. "To no country has fate been so cruel as to Russia. Her ship went down when the harbor was in sight. She had already weathered the storm when everything collapsed. All the sacrifices had been made, the work accomplished. Despair and treason seized power even when the task was already done. The long retreats were over. The ammunition shortage overcame. Arms flowed in a wide stream. A stronger, more numerous, better supplied army guarded a huge front. The rear assembly points were overflowing with men. Alexeyev led the army and Kolchak the fleet. Besides, no difficult actions were any longer required. To remain at her post, impressed with a heavy load and the widely extended German lines, to hold without showing much activity, the weakening forces of the enemy in the front. In other words, to hold on. This is all that stood between Russia and the fruit of a common victory. In March, the Tsar was on the throne. The Russian Empire and the Russian army held out. Their front was secured and victory was indisputable." Keep in mind, Churchill was no friend of the Russian monarchy. So this admission is enormous. The Russian forces sacrificed God knows how many men to rescue the French and the English as the Germans closed in. How were they repaid? Let me quote Churchill some more. Now this, pay attention. "According to the superficial fashion of our days, the Tsarist regime is commonly regarded as a blind, rotten, and incapable tyranny. But an analysis of this 30-month war with Germany and Austria should correct these facile notions. We could measure the strength of the Russian Empire by the blows it endured, the disasters it survived, the inexhaustible forces it developed, and the recovery it proved capable of. In the governance of states, when great events are taking place, the leader of a nation, whoever he may be, is condemned for failures, praised for successes. The point isn't who does the work, who draws up the plan or of struggle, censure or praise, for the outcome falls on the one who bears the authority of supreme responsibility. Why deny Nicholas this severe test? The burden of the final decision lay on him. At the summit, where events surpass human understanding, where everything is inscrutable, he had to give the answers. He was the compass needle. To fight or not to fight, to advance, retreat, go right or left, to leave or stand firm. These were the battlefields of Nicholas. Why not give him honor for this? The selfless impulse of the Russian army that saved Paris in 1914, overcoming the agonizing retreat. Without shells, the slow restoration of strength, the Brusilov victories, Russia's entry into the 1917 campaign, invincible, stronger than ever. Was not his share in all this? Despite the great and terrible mistakes, the system which he embodied, which he led, to which he gave a vital spark by his personal qualities, had by this time won the war for Russia. He's about to be struck down. A dark hand intervenes. At first clothed in madness, the Tsar leaves the scene. He and all who love him are given over to suffering and death. His efforts are belittled, his actions condemned, his memory slandered. Stop and tell me, who else proved suitable? Men of talent and courage, men ambitious and proud of spirit, brave and powerful, there was no shortage of those. No one was able to answer a few simple questions on which depended the life and glory of Russia. With the victory already in her grasp, she fell to the ground, alive, like Herod of old, devoured by worms. To me, that's an extraordinary admission. This is why the revolution, February Revolution, is bizarre. What monarch was overthrown in the throes of victory? Even when the economy was growing and doing well. Even the anti-Russian Churchill realizes how bizarre and pathological this situation was. So it has to be explained some other way. Well, you guys know I've dealt with the causes, the many causes of the Russian Revolution in probably 100 other places. I'm not going to rehash that here. I can tell you a few things, though. Tsar Nicholas was both popular and seen as a man of firm will, bringing Russia to victory over the Central Powers. On February 22nd, March 7th in the old calendar, the Tsar departed from Tsarskoe Selo for headquarters located in Mogilev, where his presence as Supreme Commander was necessary for the preparation of the decisive spring offensive. Revolutionaries of all ranks and types and persuasions were waiting for this moment to take advantage of the Emperor's absence from the capital, an attempt to overthrow the government. Time was of the essence, though, as it was clear to everyone that within a few months, this would become impossible. Increasing victories for Russian troops under the personal leadership of the Tsar would so strengthen his prestige and raise his reputation of the Tsardom that Orthodox Russia would be totally invulnerable. And the Tsar knew this too. But he didn't know and did not expect where this revolutionary push was going to come from. Subversive work, of course, as we all know, financed, supported, not just by the Germans or the Jews or whoever else, but also by Russia's so-called allies. This was not foreseen by Nicholas. It might be explained not only by the fact that at the time the anticipation of imminent victory, plans for the upcoming peace conference were already being discussed, and the Allies did not want Royal Russia to participate in the division of the fruits of victory. That's true. Their main goal was the overthrow of the autocratic state of Russia. However, they knew that if they overthrew him, it would delay the victory of the Allied powers for a long time. But that didn't matter. They're not dying there. The fateful day, March 1st, 13th, 1881, the assassination of Nicholas's grandfather, Tsar Alexander II, of course, always imprinted on the Tsar's memory. He well remembered the treacherous activities of many elite Russians during the Russo-Japanese War, the 1905 revolution they sparked. But now that movement was led, at least in part, by the State Duma, which had become the center of anti-royalist subversion. The Duma by itself did otherwise very little. They didn't pass laws. They served only as a forum for various factions of the left to discredit the Tsar and royalism in general. But it got worse, because the Tsar did not suspect the worst thing, treason on the part of his closest associates, senior military commanders, who enjoyed his full trust. And then it gets very depressing. He didn't know that his chief of staff, General Alexeyev, the commander of the Northern Front, the grotesque General Nikolai Ruzsky, and others were in close contact with the leaders of the Duma, its chairman, people like Rodzianko, Guchev, the leader of the Liberal Democrats or the Cadets, Milukov, and other oligarchs were plotting a palace coup. The Tsar finally was forced to realize that even among those in his retinue were working against him, men who constituted his closest circle. Despite success on the battlefield, economic growth domestically, it didn't matter. He was surrounded by enemies. The Tsar departed from Tsarskoe Selo on February 23rd. Riots broke out in Petrograd, sparked by false rumors of a bread shortage. That district was, at that time, an industrial area with a large working class population. Furthermore, by order of General Ivanov, who, by the way, a participant in the conspiracy against the Tsar, who later defected to the Red Army in 1920, when he was Minister of War, the 200,000 new recruits were concentrated there, awaiting dispatch. This mass of soldiers and workers were influenced by all the propaganda there in the city. The workers' strike was organized, but not one based around money or working conditions. The strikers' rallying cry was a demand for bread, which is strange, but as soon as they managed to get the crowd on the streets, it was entirely down with autocracy, down with the war. The Tsar received word that unrest in the capital was growing. So he contacted General Sergei Kabalov. Then, February 27th, an open military mutiny broke out. The killing of officers began. The Turaid Palace, occupied by the State Duma, became the rebels' headquarters, where that same day, two independent revolutionary bodies were formed. The Provisional Committee of the State Duma, headed by Rodzianko, and the Executive Committee of the Soviet of the Workers' Deputies. Both of these, which included left-wing Duma deputies, socialists, even criminals that they had suddenly released from prison, assumed the right to speak on behalf of all of Russia. That was the February Revolution, ultimately, a rebellion of undisciplined men and professional revolutionaries. Even if they had a tiny military unit, a regiment, a brigade, under the command of a decisive officer, that would have been enough. This was seen in the 1905 revolution, where General Alexander Miller Zelomilsky, appointed by the Tsar, with a detachment of just 200 men, selected from Warsaw Guard units, cleared the 8,000-strong Great Siberian Route in 3 weeks, clogged with trains carrying nearly 100,000 mutinous soldiers returning from Manchuria. Fortunately, the general was also a Freemason. The order was called the Grand Orient of Russia's Peoples. It lasted only a few years, but it was very political and very revolutionary. As time went on, Alexeyev was ordered to summon the 1st Guards Cavalry Division from the front back to Petrograd. This order was delayed under God, any pretext they could come up with, and not carried out. At this point, the Tsar was not receiving accurate information. That's what was going on anywhere. Conflicting reports were coming from the mayor of Petrograd, commander of the Petrograd district troops, General Kabalov, minister of internal affairs, the semi-competent Alexander Protopopov, and the chairman of the Duma, again, Rodzianko, who should never be trusted under any circumstances. This is also the day when all the Tsar's children, one after another, fell ill with a severe case of measles. So the palace was converted into an infirmary. Spring of 1916, at the request of Rodzianko, Protopopov led a delegation of Duma members with Pavel Miukov to strengthen ties with the Entente, Russia's so-called Western allies. Protopopov met with German industrialist and politician Hugo Steins, the banker Fritz Warburg, and the Swedish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Knut Wallenberg, suggesting that something was going on, especially when you consider that the Warburg family had initiated and arranged these discussions. Upon learning of the military mutiny, the Tsar decided to dispatch General Nikolai Ivanov to Petrograd, giving him extraordinary powers to restore order. Two cavalry divisions, two infantry regiments, and a machine gun detachment into action. That very same day, he had to go back to Tsarskoe Selo. But by leaving headquarters, such a critical moment, he lost direct contact with the army and effectively handed over power to General Alexeyev. But even Ivanov wouldn't take action against rioters in the city. Early in the morning of February 28th, the Tsar departed Moghilev and spent the entire day traveling. Night of March, over 1,000 miles from Petrograd. The Tsar's trains were stopped. The next station was occupied by rebels, which, by the way, turned out to be false. After an unsuccessful attempt to reach Tsarskoe Selo by another route, the Tsar decided to travel to Pskov, to the headquarters of all people, General Nikolai Rutsky, commander of the Northern Front, where he arrived that evening. This is the same Rutsky who brutally and violently forced the hand by violence to sign the prepared manifesto that they had written, so-called abdication. He said, "You sign this. Do you not see that you have nothing else left if you don't sign? I will not be responsible for your life." This itself shows that the Tsar never abdicated. However, the signature the Tsar never signed. The signature on there, we'll talk about in a second, is a tracing from something else. So he refused the command from the Rutsky character. That same evening, the Tsar had a conversation with the same Rutsky, who apparently was quite political. He wanted the Tsar's consent to a ministry controlled by the Duma, hence stripping him of power. The Tsar said, "I am responsible before God and Russia for everything that has happened and will happen." Rutsky, in his arrogance, argued with him, saying the sovereign reigns, the government rules. The Tsar told him that he misunderstood the nature of royal power and pretty much everything else. But, Rutsky didn't understand all of that because, it implies that the Tsar is at fault for everything that happens, whether it's his fault or not. The general wouldn't understand that, since he was famous for blaming his underlings for all his failures and mistakes. Now, it's true, Rutsky in a few years refused to join the Red Army and eventually was murdered by Georgi Atarbekov. I mean, he was killed by the consequences of what he put in motion. That's when the Tsar became hopeless. Well, any of us would have felt the same. He couldn't resist anymore. He was cut off from the outside world. The Tsar was their prisoner. His orders were not obeyed. Telegrams from those who remained faithful were not communicated to him. The Empress never trusted Rutsky. Upon learning the Tsar's train had been detained at Pskov, immediately realized the danger. The fateful day, March 2, 1915, arrived. During his conversation with Rutsky, the Tsar allegedly agreed to the formation of a responsible ministry. What does that mean? Responsible ministry means that the legislature selects and controls of Minister of Defense, Minister of War, Minister of the Interior. That's what that means. Orders were sent from someone, one of the revolutionaries, stop sending loyal troops to Petrograd. Same order was given by headquarters, by General Alexeyev. Rutsky relayed his conversation to Rodzianko. He deliberately misrepresented the situation in Petrograd and asked them if they agreed with his opinion to demand the Tsar's abdication. By 2:30 p.m. that day, responses from all senior commanders received all the support for their proposal. Nicholas was alone. So-called generals revolt. They all demanded abdication for the good of the motherland, for the salvation of Russia, and for the victory over the enemy. He was lied to constantly about the condition of Russia and the war itself. Even his uncle, the eldest member of the dynasty, Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, made a grave impression on him, who on bended knee implored the Tsar to abdicate. Yeah, he was shaken, but he didn't do it. The extent to which the Tsar correctly assessed the current situation and people around him is evidenced by a short entry in his diary. It simply says, "All around is treason, cowardice, and deceit." My book on the topic of, that's the title of my book on the topic, 100th anniversary of the murder of the royal family. Let me make one thing clear. Tsar Nicholas never abdicated nor resigned from office. It is forbidden by law, for one thing, and went against everything he believed. Now, it is true that Nicholas had a plan to restore the Patriarchate, where Michael would take the reins of state while Nicholas became the Patriarch. He would thus be a spiritual rather than a political figure. Russia would then be a sacral theocracy with two executives. There's many people who agree with that. It's what he said. There's plenty of precedent in Russian history. Patriarch Filaret and young Tsar Mikhail, at the time the trouble ended. Pavel Milukov, the head of the Duma at the time, told the truth in his later writings by saying Russia was doing too well for a revolution. Nicholas was in charge of the army. Russia was winning the war. How can you force such a man out? Thus, forcing a fake abdication was necessary. The generals feared that once the war was won, the Tsar would have impeccable moral authority. His generals were among the traitors, many of them exaggerating the violence throughout the country. One of the worst, General Alexeyev, because he wanted a military dictatorship for himself. German leaflets flooded the country, especially among the army, saying things like, the Tsar has given you all free land, you just have to go home to get it, and the Tsar abdicated, the war's over, etc., etc., etc. Standard Oil under the Rockefellers attempted to take the Baku oil field. The Tsar refused them. At that point, they dedicated themselves to a red victory and financed any movement against them. The strength of the Tsar was a thorn in the side of Western capitalists who wanted those resources for themselves then and today. Here's why the abdication is an obvious forgery. Number one, it's not on official stationery. That by itself proves it. Both Generals Mikhail Alexeyev and Lukomsky said that they wrote it and then handed it to the Tsar to sign. Well, that's not how it's done. Nicholas was a stickler for order. Number two, it's typewritten. It's typewritten. Royal commands were always handwritten. Number three, it's addressed only to the military chief of staff, and he was the only one to receive it. Four, there's no official imperial seal, which by itself is proof that it's a forgery. And five, the signature, which they tried to get out of the Tsar, is not his. And I know this because it's an identical tracing of a signature from a 1915 order to the fleet. Every curve and every detail is copied. It cannot be. That would be too much of a coincidence. There's a tracing of the signature that clearly is not that of Nicholas at the time. So obviously he never signed anything they put in front of him. The chief prosecutor in the Crimea today, a royalist, wrote that the document is a forgery too. She says none of the normal protocols have been followed when in the drafting of the letter. Nicholas was a stickler for these details. The abdication decree is almost certainly a fraud. She also brings up the fact that it was from a typewriter. Someone's trying to disguise their handwriting. Also, she notes, and I almost forgot, the signature is in pencil. And the signature is not in pencil ever. All of these, either by themselves or taken together, is proof that there was no abdication. He was simply forcibly removed from office, and something was written afterwards. It also shows that Western academics don't know a damn thing about Russia. And as you know, the worst part was the church. Most of the bishops supported the provisionals, the bishops of Petrim, Agafangul, Mikhail, Andrei of Ufa, even Tikhon, supported the provisional government and its right to call a synod and accepted their over-procurator, V.N. Lvov. They saw the new government as the liberation from the Prussian tyranny of the crown. The only loyal bishops were three, Makarius, Rapovitsky, and another Petrim. Here's what the church wrote concerning the supporting the revolution. The will of God has been accomplished. Russia has entered a new path, a new state life. May God bless our great homeland with happiness and glory on this new path. For the sake of the many sacrifices offered to win civil freedom, for the sake of the salvation of your own families, for the sake of the happiness of the homeland, abandon at this great historical moment all quarrels and disagreements. Unite in brotherly love for the good of Russia. Trust the provisional government. All together and everyone individually apply your efforts to this end. By your labors, exploits, prayer, and obedience, you may help its great work introducing new principles of state life. And this was written with full knowledge that these were all high-level Freemasons. Metropolitan Vladimir and Archbishop Arseny organized sedition in the church, forced through the rewriting of prayers to exclude prayers for the Tsar. They became Republicans. Any final words to the army? They were never allowed to reach the troops. In my first book, I took the abdication as a real thing. I made an error. I don't even think his last words were true. I think I thought that General Alexeyev wanted to be a military dictator. Then the next day, March 8th, the Tsar bid farewell to all the ranks of his staff. Duty General's office. The Tsar spoke with an even voice, clearly, distinctly. But his simple words sank into everyone's souls. It was unimaginably difficult for everyone, especially for him. Everyone was weeping. One person fainted. General atmosphere in the hall became extremely tense. Well, we know what happened. I think everyone knew that once he was arrested, deprived of power, that it was just a matter of time before he was going to be killed. Obviously, he was a popular man. The whole thing is absolutely disgusting. This is a very, very, very depressing story, I know. But it's very hard to find historical examples of a situation where a popular leader, victorious in warfare, with an excellent economy, is overthrown. And of course, later on, the histories were rewritten to make it seem like none of that was true. Textbooks on Russian history are a disaster. They take Red and provisional Menshevik propaganda for granted. Russia had never been doing, was never doing better than by 1917, despite the losses of the war. He was a great man and a saint and a martyr. Nicholas is a man that we can look up to whenever we're alone, whenever we don't have anybody, whenever we're sick, whenever we think that no one cares or no one understands. Tsar Nicholas is someone we can look to, always, always look to him. He went way beyond what a statesman is. He was the Tsar martyr himself, and he said he was going to sacrifice himself for the sins of Russians, these very Russians. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.